those of us at normal, even if we enjoy senior status, we will find ourselves there late in the evening and on weekends stuffing envelopes, the envelopes that you receive that invite you and inform you to events. And so as I stuffed these envelopes back in the mid-1990s, one came across and it said, Rick Steves. Well, that's not such an uncommon name. I thought, could be. And sometime later, I saw a check be processed through normal, and it said Rick Steves, and it said ETB. I thought, no, it's not possible. It's simply not possible that Rick Steves, the gentleman I see on TV in his PBS show, walking around, showing everybody how to get around Europe, and it just shattered. And even someone like myself, working at normal, it shattered the stereotype. To the extent there even is a stereotype, and of course, there really should be none in respects of people who use marijuana. So Rick and I started corresponding. I asked if he wanted to be involved, if he wanted to come to conferences, and he said, maybe. Possibly. However, like all of us, there's a time and place where you come out, where you publicly engage this. And so a few years ago, Rick started to, in his many media events he does around the country, that he helps raise money for PBS stations around the country, he started to talk about the fact that he thought marijuana laws should change. And I think it was even on the Ron Owen show right here in San Francisco, which I did the other day, where he was asked the question, what is your favorite flavor of gelato? And his answer was?
Cannabis.
Cannabis. Hemp. As if that's a flavor of gelato. Maybe in the Steves household. I've never seen it traveling in Italy, so. But a couple of years ago, Rick, in concert with his family and his co-workers, and while I don't know if it's an employee-owned organization, it seems like both the employees and Rick have a lot of respect for each other, and Rick did not want to threaten what is a very commercially successful company. And as the comfort level rose in his family and in his company, I said, all right, if you're inclined, if this is something you feel very strongly about, we support you too. And so we're blessed today to have for the second time, but as our keynote speaker, great travel author, wonderful person, devoted father, and a great ambassador for America to the world at a time when we don't have as many as we should. Rick Steves.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Alan, for those kind words. Thought I'd talk to you about, there's probably a lot of travelers in here, in this room. Anybody been to Europe? All right. Sightseeing, I'm sure. Well, what I've done for the last 25 years or so is teach people how to travel. And I write guidebooks and make a TV series and run a business up in Seattle. And it just occurs to me that travel is a great way to broaden our perspectives. And I think it's more important than ever that Americans find ways to broaden their perspectives. When I think back on when I first went to Europe, I remember I didn't want to go. I was just a kid, but for a lot of people, it's kind of scary to have to broaden your perspectives. My parents made me go to Europe. My dad used to import pianos, and I went to see the piano factories in Germany and the relatives in Norway, you know. And as a little 14-year-old kid, on day two, it occurred to me, well, this isn't so bad. In fact, it's quite interesting. You know, it's a cool way to spend your extra time and money. I mean, you're over here, different candy, different pop, women with hairy armpits. Yeah, it's an interesting world we live in. And I gained a taste for traveling, and I sort of vowed to go back to Europe every other time. I remember it occurred to me I don't need my parents anymore, looking at other kids with backpacks and rail passes and so on. And I got pretty good at traveling just because that's where I spent my summers. And after three or four trips, it occurred to me if I could just package the lessons I've learned from my mistakes, other people could learn from my mistakes rather than their own and have better trips. So that's what I've been doing for my career is spending 100 days a year in Europe, making all the mistakes, losing my traveler's checks just to see what will happen. When I get ripped off, I celebrate because they don't know who they just ripped off. I'm going to come home and put that into my lectures, into my books. I teach travel. And I've spent basically a third or a quarter of my adult life in Europe, living out of a carry-on airplane-sized suitcase, and that tends to mess up an American a little bit. It makes you sort of an odd duck in our society. And I just love coming home from my travels and trying to encourage, inspire, stimulate, teach people how to better understand our world through travel. To me, travel is accelerated living. You make more friends and you learn more per day when you're away from home than you do at home. Everything becomes very vivid. I mean, and when I'm in Europe for a month, I can recall every meal from that last month. I can just, it's just like nostalgic to think back on every meal. Can't do that when I'm at home. It's just not quite as vivid. Travel really challenges truths. And to me, this is pretty exciting. I mean, you're raised thinking certain truths are self-evident and God-given. And then you get over there and you realize people do things differently. Travel rearranges your furniture. I mean, you go to Bulgaria and all of a sudden this means yes. And that means no. And you go to France and slow service is good service. Slow service is respectful service. You got the table all night. Take your time. You go to Belgium and they dip their French fries into mayonnaise. They look at you strange if you ask for ketchup. Ooh, this just stimulates me. I go to Japan and I'm in a ryokan and it's the middle of the night and it's cold. They don't heat their houses. And you slip on your slippers and you put on your kimono and you shuffle down the hallway. You can see your breath. You're not looking forward to sitting onto that toilet. You sit on the toilet and the seat is heated. That's a nice jolt halfway through the night. So travel carbonates your life. It makes things different. It gives you, it sort of refreshes your perspective. And in a lot of ways, it's like marijuana, I would say. When in my travels, it gives me a broader perspective. And I really like that. When I started teaching, I wondered, is this a noble thing to teach rich Americans to do, go travel. My image of travel when I was a kid was rich white Americans on big cruise ships in the Caribbean throwing coins off the deck, photographing black kids jumping for those coins, and it was a way to flaunt your affluence, and that was just, people didn't think twice about it. That's what travel was all about. Even today, that notion of travel persists. For a lot of people, travel is still, you know, see if you can eat five meals a day and still snorkel when you get into port. And that's not really something I wanted to promote. I wanted to promote thoughtful travel. And in the last few years, thoughtful travel, I think, has become more important than ever for Americans. I'm really committed to the notion that travel is a constructive, healthy thing to do. That's nothing new. 1,400 years ago, Muhammad said, "Don't tell me how educated you are, tell me how much you've traveled." Thomas Jefferson said, "Travel makes a person wiser but less happy." Think about that. Mark Twain traveled, and he said, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness." I travel, and it occurs to me it's one of the last great sources of legal adventure. When you travel, you realize there's things to get excited about. I mean, I grew up thinking cheese was the same size as the bread, and it's just orange. Then you go over there, and cheese is different. I mean, they got a different cheese for every day of the year. You go into a cheese shop in Paris, it's like a festival of mold. And I love hanging around with my restaurateur friends in Paris. And I'm their little American bumpkin, and they can show me an appreciation of the fine points of life. And she takes me into the cheese shop, picks up the moldiest wad. "Oh, Rick, smell this cheese. It smells like the feet of angels." Now, imagine thinking cheese smells like the feet of angels. It just changes your perspective on things. I was in Kabul once in Afghanistan. A professor sat down next to me. He said, "You're American, aren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I want you to know that..." He said, "I'm a professor here in Afghanistan, and I just want you to know that a third of the people on this planet eat with spoons and forks like you do, a third of the people eat with chopsticks, and a third of people eat with their fingers like I do, and we're all just as civilized." And I was thankful for that. He had a little chip on his shoulder, and he wanted to talk to every American he could meet and say, he's not less civilized because he eats with his fingers. I was in eastern Turkey, in a land that might be called Kurdistan someday. I met a carver who was famous in his corner of his country. Everybody wanted a prayer niche carved by him. And we visited with him, and he was so proud to be showing off his work to these American travelers. I remember he lifted his chisel up into the sky, and he said, "A man and his chisel, the greatest factory on earth." Wow, there's a fulfilled guy. He doesn't even know how to turn on a computer, but he can make his own, he can define his own success. And I thought that was pretty cool. When you travel, you just meet people. You meet people all over the place. A little while ago in Germany, a little kid, like a five-year-old kid, was just staring at me. And finally his mom said, "Excuse my son, he stares at Americans." You see, last week we were at McDonald's, and he was having his hamburger, and he asked me, "Why do Americans have such soft bread?" And the mother told his kid, "Because they have no teeth." So now he stares at Americans, and I showed him my teeth. you know, travel puts you in your place. I'm as inclined as the next American to brag about how well our athletes do at the Olympics, and I grew up marveling at how great we were. We're always USA on top of that Olympic medal list. Well, until my Dutch friend said, well, you got a lot of Olympic medals, but per capita, we're doing 8 times as well as you. You know, you just don't think of looking at the Olympic gold medal listing in terms of per capita when you measure things. It's so exciting to broaden your perspectives, and at the same time, it's important to bring it home, and share it with people that way. I'll never forget, we were trying to bring it home with our kids, and, you know, we were at, Grandma and Grandpa came over, and my son was about 4 years old or 3 years old, and after table prayers, I taught him to say, Allah, 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 just to freak out my dad. you know, it's just, you got to put people a little bit outside of their comfort zone to share with you what you've learned from your travels. Well, one thing I learned from my travels is how Europe is a little more progressive than us in a lot of issues dealing with social problems. I mean, every time there's a death sentence commuted in the United States, there's a light show on the Colosseum in Rome. They celebrate in Europe when we commute a death sentence in the United States. We don't celebrate that here, but they do in Europe. And of course, when you travel in Europe, you do realize that there is a non-criminal approach to marijuana, which can be quite inspirational, I think, to American policymakers if they would just learn about it. When we think about trips, thank you. You know, you can take a trip with your marijuana, or you can take a trip with your passport. And it's kind of fun to take a trip without having to travel. I mean, you know, just put me in a nice location with a National Geographic and a joint, and I'm climbing Mount Everest. I mean, that's travel. It's really quite cheap. There's a budget trick if your dollar is too low. And then, you know, you can do your actual travel and mix some appreciation of marijuana into that, and it becomes kind of super travel. And for a lot of Americans, they're just not edgy enough here to smoke when it's illegal, but it's enjoyable for them to have an opportunity to enjoy, you know, some recreational use of marijuana without any of the paranoia that comes with doing that publicly in the United States. First time I ever smoked was in Afghanistan, and I just was sort of, as a kid, I didn't want peer pressure to make me do something my parents said I shouldn't, you know. Got over there, and it was just like going local. It was when in Rome, you know, and when in Afghanistan, this is what you do. The bus stops, everybody gets around and sort of watches a goat get slaughtered and pass around the bong. I mean, you stand on the rooftop of your hotel in Herat, and there's chariots going by porch-lit, and the light bulbs are all breathing, and people are eating soup with their hands, and they don't drop a bit. And you travel on over to Nepal, and you can look right into the eyes of the living virgin goddess, the Kumari Deva. You got these slow motion leech attacks, and everybody is going, Namaste, Namaste, I salute your virtues. And you write in your journal, trying to catch all this stuff, and you get home, and you hardly remember where you were high and where you weren't, but when you read it, there's a certain dreaminess that comes into your journal writing that you can sort of derive. It can't be that great. I must have been high. When I teach a writer's workshop, a lot of times people will ask me, well, what's a trick? How can I be a better travel writer? And one of the schools of travel writing is to be able to experiment with your perspective. It's smoking pot if you want to sharpen your ability to be a good travel writer. And, you know, like photographers will experiment with light. Any good photographer is going to play around with existing light. It's a fascinating thing. Well, as a travel writer, you'll want to experiment with different perspectives on things. I mean, you know, when you're a keen observer, you can try to kill flies forever on the bed in Cairo, but if you realize when they're rubbing their little front feet together, they're toast. You can get them when they're doing this, you see. When you're in Shanghai, you see these, skyscrapers. They're throwing up a skyscraper every day, the equivalent of a skyscraper a day in Shanghai, surrounded by a sea of poverty. And when you write about that, you've got to be able to see these skyscrapers as stilettos, just sticking up through this fertile soil of a billion people. And it's just so much fun to be able to try to take your observations and make them a little more from a different angle so people can better enjoy that. You're looking into the eyes of Michelangelo's David, and you're actually seeing him sizing up the darkness of medieval superstition and so on, right there, 500 years ago when Florence was pulling Europe out of the Dark Ages. As a tour guide, it's a very... I take groups around Europe. We take, you know, 5,000 people around Europe every year on 200 different tours, and for 25 years I've been taking groups around Europe, and You know, we have to be a little bit careful about our approach to this sort of thing, but if you take a group to Morocco, you're going to encounter marijuana. And most of these people are freaked out because they've seen movies about people getting arrested in foreign countries because of pot. But I was with a group in a little town in marijuana, quite famous for its marijuana, and Sichuan, and a man comes out of an alley in a flowing robe, and he says, "Do you want to smoke some pot?" And I've got my group with me, and I look at my group and I look at him and I say, "Yes." Now my group didn't want to smoke pot, and I, as a respected tour guide, I wasn't about to encourage that, but I said, "I'll just smoke it, and I'm going to explain to you what it's like to have all these what it's all like to have all these cobblestones flowing by me. We're in a river going up this lane here." And I think it was one of the better tour guiding moments I've had, actually. One thing fun about travel is my thing is European travel, and it shows you a European perspective on things. And when you go to Europe and you're thoughtful, and this is one thing I'm dealing with, is getting my travelers engaged to travel thoughtfully. Not just fun in the sun, not just bingo, not just shopping, but thoughtful travel. You realize you're going to a continent where people realize that a society has to make a choice. You can tolerate alternative lifestyles or you can build more prisons. But you've got to make a choice. In Europe, they'd rather tolerate alternative lifestyles. In our society, we'd rather build more prisons. You know, we live in a country where the hottest things in real estate are gated communities for the wealthy and prisons for the poor. And we're oblivious to this. I mean, I don't know why we don't see this as a political issue, but it's a scary thing. Europeans are quick to remind me that my country has 4% of the world's population with 25% of its prisoners. That's not a good statistic. Europe has learned that you cannot legislate personal morality. It's futile. It's counterproductive. The Dutch consider when they see the Dutch say, "We're businessmen. If there's a problem, we deal with that person as if he's a future customer or partner." The Dutch have so many creative ways to solve problems. You can complain about junk mail all you want. In the Netherlands, they've got stickers on their mailboxes that says yes or no when it comes to junk mail, so they don't get junk mail unless they want it. You know, Americans say, "We can't have pedestrian street because then I can't get my car to my shop." Well, in Europe, they've got pedestrian streets with little swipe things for your little local credit card, and you swipe it and the pillar goes down and you can drive in if you're a resident, but otherwise it's traffic free. In the Netherlands, 40% of the traffic is on two wheels. There's entire communities in Europe that are going to be wind powered. There's a race going on right now for that. They know how to solve their problems and deal with their problems in ways that think out of the box. And as Europe unites, it's getting more impressive what they're doing. It's easy to write off Europe as the old world, but they've got a bigger economy and a bigger population than we do right now. 400 million people with $11 trillion GDP, and they're not spending half of their disposable income on the military. They're investing it in their own infrastructure, and it's breathtaking what's going on over there. The hard choices we're making to find $60 billion to cover our government's budget needs are coming right into people's programs that weaken our communities, whereas in Europe, that'd be the last thing they would be cutting. Europe knows how to deal with some of these social problems. Prostitution, there's no disease, there's no crime with prostitution in Europe. They've arranged it in a way where prostitutes have their own unions. They've got tipple zones in the Netherlands. A tipple zone is where it's the sound a mouse makes when it runs across the floor. Tipple, 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 tipple. And they've got these, instead of having the lowest class of prostitutes, the drug addicts are on the streets, these are the people that are put in a tipple zone. And there they've got a clinic, and they've got a responsibility to visit with the doctors and the health people. And they know that these people are going to be dealing with their hard drug problems and not spreading diseases. And these days, when a prostitute in the Netherlands has trouble, she pulls her emergency cord or pushes her emergency button. A pimp doesn't come, but the police come. And that's a good way to solve that kind of problem that's not going to go away otherwise. Well, of course, when we think about the Netherlands, we think about coffee shops. And boy, oh boy, coffee shops in the Netherlands, you look at one of their menus, it reads like a drug bust in our country. And they've got all the loaner bongs. They've got email. You go to check your email, and you realize, oh, this is a coffee shop cyber cafe. It's a community center for people who want to go out socially and enjoy a little pot. And it's also considered by law enforcement officers and health officials in the Netherlands as a good wall between the responsible adult use of soft drugs and hard drugs. And there's nothing soft about hard drugs in the Netherlands. I mean, they are anti-hard drug problems, and it is classifying marijuana as in the category of alcohol and tobacco. But the law enforcement officers see it as a wonderful way to communicate with people who have problems with hard drugs. They go to the coffee shops. If there's a problem with some chemical drug or if there's something they want to communicate, that's where they go. And the people who run these coffee shops serve as a nice wall between problems with hard drugs and recreational use among adults for marijuana. Now, after 15 years of this, the Netherlands, it's clear, even people who are against drugs are in favor of decriminalizing marijuana. Teen use does not go up. There's 15 years experience with that. The crime element around drugs goes way, way down, and it's a good way to communicate with hard drug problems and deal with that more effectively. In the Netherlands now, this model works well. Many places in Europe, they're doing progressive things, but it's tough with the United States pressure now. I had people in Copenhagen tell me they have to arrest a couple of pot smokers every year just to maintain favored trade status with the United States of America. That's a pathetic thing. Well, coming home for me is always a little bit of a jolt. You know, the first person that meets me at the airport is a dog. And I just can't help but think One Nation Under Surveillance. You know, and come home to the land of the... you know, we pride ourselves in having this life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but we've got the shortest vacations in the rich world. We've got an uptight situation about sex where even my TV shows are rated for mature audiences only. I mean, if you can imagine that, David's going to be pixelated here pretty soon. I mean, TV programmers around the United States now, when I do travel shows on PBS, if you don't know, and they've got a list of how many seconds of marble penis and canvas breast are showing in my as I show art from Europe, because a lot of programmers can't inflict a Titian painting or a Michelangelo statue on their viewership in some conservative communities. So in a lot of regards, we're going in the wrong direction in this society, and that's why I think it's just great for all of us to get together and encourage each other and break from this huddle and go back into our communities. Of course, jailing people for pot in Europe would be laughable, and but that's not the case here in the United States. Now, in so many ways, I think we are just living a lie, and that's one reason why I got involved in Normal. I just don't think if you're a successful, affluent, free country, you need to have lies. You don't need to embrace lies to con your electorate into this or that. Now, you know, we just heard that intelligence on weapons of mass production was mistaken, you know, and we all believe that, oh, they didn't know that. I mean, somebody should just say BS, I think, when they get these kind of admissions later on. We are the only nation voted, we're outvoted routinely 140-4 in the United Nations on issues of environmental stuff, on development in the third world, on criminal court, on Cuba, on Israel. It's 140-4. Who stands with us? Israel, Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. Those are the people that vote with us in the United Nations. That's what I call a rogue nation. If there's something going on to work on problems with desperately poor people, there's one country that gets in the way, the USA. If you know, if Canada wants to give discounted medicine for AIDS to Africa, who gets in the way of it? We do. It's just, if Americans knew this, if it could be communicated effectively, I think it would be not a very tough sell to get our country a little more tuned into the needs of people on this planet. But we are embracing these lies. We buy this stuff. No Child Left Behind. Clean skies. I love trees. The party of life. Tax relief. Death tax. All of this terminology we just embrace. They call it the Defense Department. You know, nobody should ever let that word go by without a challenge. It's not a Defense Department. In this country, we spend as much as the rest of the world put together in the military, and you can't get elected without promising more. There's a mania in that regard, and it's a big problem. We hear that we're for peace, and we've got these Christian values, but we're pounding plowshares into swords these days at record pace. And somebody's got to stand up and just say, you know, when Bush talks about freedom and liberty, he's talking about freedom to other people's natural resources and liberty to use their cheap labor. That's what they're talking about. I was just down in El Salvador last week, and boy, I just wanted to see what's going on in the developing world. And they've got their struggles between the left and the right down there, and the left-wing party in El Salvador was almost going to win the president's election last year, and President Bush had to send his brother, Jeb, down there to stand by the right-winger and tell the Salvadorans, if you vote for the left-wing, we're going to stop remittances coming down from all the refugees working in the United States, which is a third of the money in that El Salvadoran economy. Well, all the people vote the right-wing against their interests because of the threat by the United States. That's democracy these days. The leading Jesuit priest, educator in El Salvador, said whenever he hears the term democracy these days, his bowels move. So, by the way, I've got a journal about that. I'm just very happy to get that up just the last couple of days. If you're curious about what I learned down in El Salvador, it might be interesting to you. It's at ricksteves.com, and you're welcome to check that out. Well, one thing I'm concerned about is the mass dumbing down of our society. And when all this stuff I've been talking about, we go, yeah, but the average person, they don't get it, you know, and it's because of fear, I think, and because they're trying to dumb us down. Powerful forces in our society would find it convenient if we all become just mindless producer consumers. We've got to not let them dumb us down, because when we're dumbed down, that's the only way political initiatives against the interest of the people in general can have a chance. The news is not news. Reality TV is not reality. When you see steroids on TV and Michael Jackson and Terry Schiavo and so on, nobody's talking about the big issues. I mean, every day, if you care about people, if you're in the sanctity of life, every day, three times as many people who died on 9/11 die in Africa, every day because of AIDS. That could be dealt with. That's a real problem. You know, we hear about the tsunami, but then it's gone out of the news. And nobody tells us that every week there's a tsunami worth of innocent children that die of starvation on this planet. It's just structural poverty. And America is the flag bearer of this structural poverty around the planet. And as good people, we can encourage our neighbors and so on to get a little more progressive about that. Now, I guess the problem with marijuana is if they're trying to make us just mindless producer consumers, marijuana is not good on either account. It doesn't make us want to produce more, and the only thing we would consume more is Cheetos. I think marijuana, the thing that the society doesn't like about marijuana is it turns people who wouldn't otherwise be poets into poets. You know, you can think of Maslow's famous... think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, in college, remember that? And first you get your clothes and your car and your house, and then you can do things that are more creative and so on. And actually on the top you got selfless actualization, helping other people. It's more convenient in our society to have barbed wire here so that we continue to consume out and out and out, not realize we can step over the barbed wire and live more fulfilling lives. One of the reasons why philosophically I'm into marijuana is because it's a good way to cut that barbed wire and be true to yourself and be what really is successful. Now, to sell this propaganda, it's the big lie thing. And Hitler learned you can tell a big lie and tell it over and over again and people believe it if you tell it enough times. And we've got to recognize the propaganda, and the problem with the propaganda that's going out in our society, I think, is it erodes the credibility. It erodes the credibility of the government, of schools, of families. When it comes to marijuana, I mean, we've got a government, a White House, that spends millions of dollars advertising in the Super Bowl trying to tell people that marijuana causes teen pregnancies. It's surrounded by beer ads. I mean, what's causing the pregnancies? You know? I've got teachers, friends who are teachers, and this DARE program, by any teacher's assessment, is somewhere between ineffectual and counterproductive. When you've got a DARE officer coming to school, they'll meet with the teachers in the teacher's lounge. These teachers, who are free spirits, Dead Poet Society kind of stuff, you know, they are cowed into silence when the DARE officer is there. You can hear a pin drop in the teacher's lounge. Nobody will question DARE because it is bad news for your job security. If you are known as somebody who is a little bit open-minded about creative ways to deal with problems with drugs in children. It is so exciting to go to a DARE meeting at school and question it. I mean, every parent there wants to do it, but they're just too chicken. Every parent knows this is bogus, but they just are afraid, and this fear is what's keeping us down. At home, I'm a parent, I've got two teenage kids. My wife is a nervous wreck. You know, us parents are taught that this is a gateway drug, and it's 20 times as powerful as back when we did it innocently and when we were kids and all this kind of stuff. Well, I guess for me, I'm so excited about having credibility with my kids. And one of the perks I get for being on the advisory board here at Normal is I can invite Keith Stroop over for dinner, and he'll come, and he'll sit down with our kids. And I was just so excited to introduce my children, my teenage kids, to a lawyer who has dedicated his life to defending an ideal rather than people with a lot of money. Yeah. And there's a nobility in our struggle that I think can be explained to people a little better. And I think, for me, I didn't tell Keith this yet, I don't think, but my daughter just wrote a paper. She got to choose whatever topic she wanted, and it was why marijuana should be decriminalized. And I just read the teacher's response to it like 2 days ago. She got an A, but the teacher said in the comments, "We don't all have to agree with you, but it's a good paper." So, well, I think an underlying thing about this propaganda war in our part of our government about marijuana is even more than stopping kids from drug problems. I think what's motivating them even more than that is instilling fear in parents. Because fear is the only way they're going to keep us down. And normally I'm not talking about decriminalization of marijuana. I'm talking about foreign policy and 9/11 stuff and terrorism, because that relates to my travel stuff more directly. But it is the same thing. Our government wants us to be afraid, and the fear enables them to manipulate us this way. We've got, for goodness sakes, we've got doctors and scientists and medical experts that have to be politically correct to give our government advice. It's sort of a bad news to make Hitler parallels, but that's, I mean, it's getting more and more like that. I mean, our environmental policy, our health policies, our AIDS policies are shaped by people who are driven by ideological agendas. Tears cause AIDS now. I mean, you got to wear a condom to cry, all right? They're embracing this in our government, and it's amazing to me. I was very impressed when I read in the Normal website a bulletin they sent out, the drug czar sent out to all the prosecuting attorneys, listing 20 reasons why marijuana is the devil's weed. And each one of these points is just refuted very solidly on the Normal website. But that our government would be giving this trash to prosecutors with the implication that you better be running with this sort of a standard, that's just really, somebody's got to stand up for that. Well, one great thing you know, travel teaches you a respect for history, and we should learn from history. I don't know if we learned from Prohibition or not, but we had this 13-year experiment with Prohibition, and I think any normal or any thoughtful assessment of it, it just made a lot of criminals, filled a lot of prisons, and cost our society a lot of money back in the 20s when we were outlawing alcohol. It's big government at its worst. Today, I think more and more people are waking up to this prohibition that's keeping Americans who shouldn't be criminals, that's causing so many people to be arrested every year. If one person who's arrested for marijuana is contributing to the congestion of our prisons right now, that's one person too much, really. So every time I come to a get-together like this, I enjoy it just because it reminds me how many people are tuned into this and thinking alike. But it's when we break from a huddle like this, I think it's really important that we don't preach to the choir, but preach to people who need to hear this news. I mean, one of my happiest talks I've ever given was the Hemfest in Seattle. And, you know, that was so incredible to be on that stage on a glorious day with Mount Rainier and the Puget Sound and our skyline and thousands of heads out there going, "Yeah, Rick," but I wasn't accomplishing anything. I mean, maybe I was accomplishing a little bit, but I think what I would rather do is talk to a dinner club in Dallas or something like this, which I do now, and it's quite interesting. And what I'll tell you is, when you get invited into conservative areas, our country is so riddled with fear and misinformation that people find it therapeutic for some decent person to stand in front of them and tell them, "You don't need to buy this crap." You know, if your world perspective is shaped by your husband, wake up. I tell these rich women in these incredible clubs that if your worldview is shaped by your husband, you can actually step out, you know. And if your worldview is shaped by fear of this or whatever, you can change that. We need, I think, to address the mainstream in our country. We need to be credible. We need to speak loudly and clearly. And from my experience, our country is ready for this. You know, I just saw a bumper sticker when I was coming to the airport yesterday. It says, "Land of the Free because of the Brave," instead of "Home of the Brave." And I thought, well, that was probably for the war, but I think it's a Land of the Free because of the Brave. That applies to us also. We can be more free, but we've got to be brave to share this information. So I'm a lucky guy because I can speak out on marijuana and not be elected or get fired or anything like that. I mean, if somebody says they're not going to take my tours, I say, well, it'll probably be more fun without you, you know? So, I mean, I get a lot of that, you can imagine. And I think it's kind of fun. But I think we need to find ways. We're all desensitized here. If somebody says marijuana in this room, nobody jerks. But in the general public, people twitch when you say marijuana. And I remember when I was in college, I took a human sexuality class, and the professor didn't want us twitching every time he said the word penis. So he spent 15 minutes just saying penis, penis, penis. Well, I try to say marijuana a lot, it just in mixed company, in polite company. I love to say marijuana, and a lot of people go, "Wow, did he say marijuana?" I mean, I've written 30 guidebooks, and nearly all of them have the word marijuana in them. Sometimes it's a stretch to work marijuana, but it can be done. In my business, we've got 60 people, and we've got a little thumbnail sketch of each of them, where they travel, what they do at my company, and what their favorite gelato flavor is, like Alan was talking about. And everybody's got tiramisu and chocolate and pistachio, and mine is ganja. Ganja. And it's just a fun way to let people know that you're not cowed by this. Every few months I have to open up the window in my office and just scream out the word marijuana. In my business, we've got a graffiti wall where everybody shares information, and one of the columns there is smoking marijuana in Europe. I get a lot of heat from that. That's one thing a lot of people just, how can you let people share information about smoking marijuana in Europe? And I just have to think, well, boy, regardless of what you think about the law here in the United States, that's quite ethnocentric to think that it would be wrong for us to smoke marijuana far away where they don't have laws like ours. But the people imply that if it's illegal here, when you take your being over there, all of the crazy laws of our country travel with you. That's not why we travel. You know, I find that it is fun to work normal into fundraisers. A lot of you are involved in your communities in a lot of different ways, and when I raise money, I don't like to jam one charity down on people, so I give them a choice of four. You know, Oxfam, Greenpeace, Bread for the World, YWCA, and Normal. And it's great because all of these organizations, they have to find themselves sitting at the same table with Normal, and it's a nice way to remind them that Normal is a good cause. It's caring people, it's caring people. Now, in my business, I've been talking out quite a bit, and I'm surprised. I'm a pretty paltry celebrity, if this is the best you can do, but I'm happy. I mean, it's really pathetic, isn't it? There's Woody and
Bill Maher.
And there's like four or five of us here that are known outside of our own realms. And, I know there's more people out there, but they just don't understand how good it feels to not embrace the lie and not enable the lie. And let me just tell you from a pragmatic point of view, if you're associated with any business and so on, you're wondering, what does it do? My business is not hurt by my outspokenness on peace and justice issues or marijuana. I'm not just a one-cause guy. There's not a Rastafarian flag. I've got a European flag and a peace flag, and we're all smoking pot. Okay. I think at worst it's been a wash, but I think it's actually been a plus for me if I was just to measure it in, is this good business or not? I mean, I'm going to be on 60 Minutes Wednesday next month. They traveled with me this fall, and they wanted to go to Amsterdam with me. I mean, it was amazing. They wanted to go into that coffee shop. One of the 60 Minutes guys, I'm not supposed to publicize this, but I just think with this, just between you and me, he's got a a camera in the bridge of his glasses right here. You know the camera on your cell phone, that little lens? It's probably about a little smaller than that. And then he's got his little monitor right here. And he was my silent partner as I did my sleuthing. You know, when I do my guidebooks, I'm checking hotels and restaurants and in Amsterdam coffee shops. And so he goes in with me, and it just looked like a normal guy, except he moved like a tripod, you know. And it was fun to go into my favorite coffee shops with my 60 Minutes crew. But the point is, you know, I've got a column now in the USA Today. I got a feature in New York Times Magazine. This is publicity I would have never dreamed of. And it's not because I'm selling discount tickets to Mazatlan. It's because, you know, it's because I'm really saying what travel is all about. And what's interesting is people in power in the media now have, I mean, this generation has grown into positions of power. Whether the society likes it or not, the old guys are retired, and these guys are in there now, and they still are scared to keep their jobs, so they can't be outspoken. But you can just feel the appetite they have to get somebody who is outspoken in there, you see. This is a change that's going on, and I'm quite excited about it. I think it is big. We've got thought leaders in our communities that we can confide in, that we can be close to, who respect you, you know. I go to one of the biggest churches in North Seattle, and my pastor has gone on walks with me, and I've told him why this Christian smokes pot, okay? And it's not any sort of freaky Bob Marley kind of thing. It's just, this is part of my being, you know, and it's part of truth. And now, at first he thought this was a contradiction, but now he understands this is not a contradiction. And this is a learning process that we've got to have. As we are good citizens and good part of our communities, we need to balance our activism. And I think your marijuana activism will be more effective if you're also in to, you know, the PTA and the homelessness and the schools and public television or whatever. That makes me be more credible because people know I'm into other causes also. And I feel very thankful for that because it lets me be more effective as an advocate of decriminalizing marijuana. Now, we need to have a clear message when we say this. And I mean, you just got to have these figures. 750,000 Americans were arrested last year because of marijuana, 88% of them because of simple possession. Our country blew $7 billion on this. I mean, we're talking about appealing to conservatives. This should be a conservative issue. We can talk about the European solution. 15 years they've been experimenting with treating marijuana as a medical concern instead of a criminal one, and they like it. Even crusty conservative law enforcement types like it this way. We need to preempt the discredits. They're going to say, so you're for children using abusing drugs? No, we're not for children smoking pot. We're not for hard drugs. We're not for driving when you're high, none of that stuff. But you need to preempt that because they'll discredit you right away. Every time I'm on the radio because of marijuana, it's, so drug abuse, tell me all about it. So you think drug abuse is okay? No, drug abuse is not okay. Responsible adult use is okay, but nobody's talking about kids getting easy access to pot. But we need to be straightforward about that to shoot off that torpedo before they torpedo us with it. That's right. I think it's very interesting that people think advocating for normal is advocating for breaking a law. It's not. It's advocating to change a law. And that's a very fundamental difference. And that's for that reason you should stand really strong and proud. I'm not saying smoke pot. I'm saying it's wrong to arrest people who want to smoke pot maturely as adults. Or you could do the medical thing. But, you know, there's a difference there. We're not saying break the law. So, you know, I want to support normal publicly like I support travel. I think it's freedom. It's a matter of freedom. I think it's recess, and we need it in this society. Yeah. Now, you know, being high to me is a little bit like Cuba. you know, anytime my government says I can't go somewhere, I feel it's one of my rights to go there. My government can't tell me I can't go to Cuba. Everybody else go to Cuba. Why can't I go to Cuba? And I don't think my government can tell me what I can do as a responsible citizen in the privacy of my own home. We need to challenge our friends. I mean, this is a frustrating thing to me. There's so many pot smokers out there that don't even put two and two together. You know, to me, normal is not a charity. Normal is a service, and it's something I am really thankful for. So, happy travels, even if you're just staying home. Thank you very much.
Wow.